This is the Medicast, December 3rd, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 95. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show tonight. If you're a brand new listener or listening to the show by some kind of downloadable means, maybe somebody's forwarded you an email with the show content buttons on it, you can go ahead and check out new ways to get to the show and subscribe over at medicast.com. Please subscribe and you can get the show delivered to you directly every week. And of course, for you long-term listeners, I'd like to welcome you all back to the show, and I will do the best I can tonight. It's about 12:30 a.m., and with all of the upcoming holiday things going on and family activities, as well as some new updates for the site, I have been working hard to get some things done before I recorded the show, and lo and behold, it's 12:30. And I'm going to do the best I can and get through the show tonight and have a good show together for you this evening. We'll be looking at some things to do with tachycardia and some more on ACLS review. And I'll also be looking at the medication adenosine. And all of that will be coming up later in the tip and trick and med of the week. I'll talk about the site updates and things I've been working on a little bit later in the link of the week. And I want to jump right now and get on into some listener mail because it's been a while since I've covered that. And I got a couple of interesting items I'd like to bring up in this week's listener mail. The first item I got was a piece I got. I've been conversing with this listener about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks now. And it's listener Aaron. He is an I-85, EMT I-85, National Registry, and is converting right now to I-99. He is looking for some information on some good ways to prepare himself through the program he's in. It's really a self-study program, and he's really having some difficulty getting the right materials. And I had mentioned to Aaron that I think he's doing the right thing by listening to the Medicast, listening to other great EMS podcasts that are available out there. And I think that he can also help himself out by checking out some of the more detailed podcasts on things like PHTLS. There's a PHTLS podcast over at iTunes. Maybe some of the anatomy and physiology podcasts. There's some trauma podcasts. There's a ton of great medical content available at the iTunes store and also in other podcast directories. So, Aaron, I hope that you are able to get that worked out. And also, if you're interested, I would also urge any of you that are going through this to check out Rick Rosati's Mitigation Journal podcast. Rick's podcast is an excellent resource for people that are looking for information on disaster preparedness. And Rick himself also is teaching an I-99 bridge program right now, I believe. So if you're interested in information on that, you might also want to touch base with him as well. I got another interesting comment from listener Victor. And Victor is an EMTB from California who recently moved to Texas with his wife. And he is looking to become a paramedic and getting ready to enroll in school, but he does have a learning disability and wanted to know if I was aware of any information about people who have specific learning issues, not having to do with specific intelligence problems, because of course learning disabilities have nothing to do with intelligence, but on ways to engage themselves in their learning styles. Victor, this is an excellent question, and it's something that may pose some difficulties for people, but I think most colleges and universities are very aware of learning disabilities and have programs or at least some resources to help engage learners in different styles of learning that may be supportive for them. Also, of course, there are other resources that you can find on your own, resources like podcasts, like the Medicast and other programs that are out there, as well as other resources that may be available from your state or local agencies. You might also want to touch base with your local Board of Education. They may have some information and resources available from the local public school system, or at least you might be able to get in touch with a teacher who is a teacher involved in helping people with learning disabilities, and that teacher may have some resources and links to programs for you as well. In any case, I think the most important thing is to be aware of what specific requirements will be made of you when you go to test in your jurisdiction. And I make that statement because in the state of Maryland, people can have some assistance with learning disabilities up to taking the final exam. And at that point, the state medical director has made a decision that says that there are certain accommodations that will not be made in the final, that a person needs to be able to do certain things to a certain level of proficiency before they can become licensed EMTs or paramedics in the state of Maryland. This specifically has to do with things like having a reader for exams. Basically, the idea being, according to what I've heard on statements from the medical director, have been that if a person can't read a test and be able to understand a question, how can they be relied upon to read patient information, successfully understand and copy things like prescription bottles and medication lists? And so this is why this particular decision has been made. And that's based upon my understanding of the program as it sits. So, Aaron, it's important for you and anyone else to make sure you understand whatever limitations may be held for you at the testing level, and check in with your local jurisdictions about specifically how that will be handled. Okay, let's move on into some voicemail comments. Got some calls into the voicemail line at 941-306-3342, and I'll play the first one right here.
Yeah, Jamie, this is Mark. I had a quick question. I was wondering if any of the other podcasters out there listening to your show had any problems with the... I've been downloading it from iTunes on my... iPod, and about halfway through listening to your podcast, it all of a sudden frees up. For whatever reason, it only does it with the Medicast. And I was just wondering if you have heard from any of the other listeners if they were having the same problem. Just send me an email. Let me know whether or not you've heard of this problem occurring elsewhere. I'm on the road right now trying to listen to your podcast, but unfortunately I can't now. But keep up the good work. Thanks.
Mark, thank you very much for getting in touch with me. You know, I have been personally experiencing some problems with some other podcasts that seem to stop halfway through and they don't play all the way through. And it seems like I didn't download the whole file or something. And I went back and have done some checking around on some of the forums. And I think maybe people may be having the same problem with my own podcast. And it may have to do with the hosting service that a lot of podcasters use to handle their downloads. It's a lot of money to pay for bandwidth, and there's a few services out there that offer bandwidth at reduced cost, kind of an unlimited downloads thing. You just pay for what you upload, and they cover the download bandwidth. I think their feeling is that a lot of podcasts don't have that many listeners, and so they're able to cover the high-end podcasts without by having the people that are not filling the total cost of what they're paying. But I think that may be having some issues right now. If anyone else is having problems with this, the solution I've found has been to go ahead into iTunes and re-download the episode. It seems to fix the problem usually on the second download. It seems to grab the file. It seems to happen intermittently, so it shouldn't happen all the time. And I'm going to look into this and make sure that this is not happening on a more recurring basis, that it's just an intermittent and problem that hopefully they'll solve and get taken care of. But Mark, I thank you for your comment. Anyone out there, don't just assume somebody else has had the same problem. If you think there's an issue with the download or something that you're finding problems with getting access to the website, please send me an email at podmedic@mac.com or call the voicemail line and let me know so that I can get the problem solved for you and the other listeners. And Mark, thanks again for your comment.
Yeah, hi. I'm taking an EMTB course, and I do a lot of traveling around with my job. I'm a volunteer in the fire department in town. And I was wondering if you might know where I might be able to get an audio book. Been listening to your podcast, but I was wondering if you might know where I might be able to get an audio book. We've been using the Emergency Care by Brady. I don't necessarily need to be that book, but I was just wondering if you know if any of the other manufacturers may have an audio book that I could copy to my iPod or an iPod cast where they produce it.
Thank you very much for that voicemail. And I think that listener's initial, at least, is G. He left his email address for me at the end of that comment, and I clipped it off so that the rest of you didn't send him email as well. But that's a really great question, and I'm not aware of any of the major textbook publishers producing any of their textbooks as major audiobooks. In other words, they might have portions on their website of some additional content, but I am not aware of any of the major textbook publishers in any field publishing their textbooks as audiobooks. That said, you might want to check on some resources for the disabled. We just talked about things for people with learning disabilities. But, you know, the reason a lot of people like podcasting and audio podcasts in particular is because it's something you can listen to during your commute times, times when you really just have some, your brain has downtime. You don't have to do anything except pay attention to your driving, and you'd like to listen to some content. And that's why I think a lot of you listen to the Medicast and find it rewarding, at least from what I've heard from the listeners. So I don't know of anything like that, but you might check with resources for visually impaired persons. There may be textbooks out there in those arenas that may be available for you. Other than that, I really don't know of anything in that specific realm. If you're looking for content like that, I would really check out other episodes of the Medicast in the past and other podcasts that are out there, other information and downloadable audio that you can get and load onto your particular content. You might check the medical sections of the podcasting areas of the different directories like iTunes or the Zune Marketplace, and you should be able to find some other medical content that may be pertinent to whatever units you're studying in that particular week. I'm going to have some information, hopefully in the next month or two, that I'm going to have more targeted towards both BLS and ALS providers that I'll have up on the site in more of a targeted way so that you can find the content. Otherwise, I would suggest maybe looking at the list of tips and tricks on the Medicast site. You'll find that in the left-hand side where it says list of tips and tricks and list of meds of the week, and you'll be able to find content there that might be more pertinent to you. And I hope that answers your question. And guys, keep the voicemails and the emails coming. Again, you can reach me at podmedic@mac.com. You can also check in with me on the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. You can also check out the brand new Medicast forums over at forums.medicast.com. I've set up a listener social site over there at the Ning.com website engine, and you can get there directly at forums.medicast.com. You can sign up for a username, password there for free, and access the Medicast forums. I have already started a couple of forum posts over there where you can drop some ideas and comment on other people's ideas for upcoming tips and tricks of the weeks or meds or anything other topics you'd like to see me cover here at the show. And also, there's a place to discuss ALS things, BLS things, and you can start your own topic area if you don't see what you like there. Just remember to be respectful of each other, and we can have some great conversations directly over at the MedicCast forums. So check that out. Let's jump on into this week's news now. I guess you guys probably figured out by now that I'm a bit of a techno nerd. I really enjoy new technologies and talk about them quite a bit here on the show. And there's an item that showed up in the news this past week that really kind of gets me excited about what we could be seeing in the backs of our own units or in our local rural facilities. If you're at a local hospital or a local medical center where you are that you transport to, you may see some new telemedicine advances being used. The item I found in the news was over at emsresponder.com talking about telemedicine bringing stroke specialists to rural Colorado hospitals. This is really kind of really, I think, cool. It is a program called CODOC, and that stands for Colorado Digital Online Consultants. And hospitals across the state of Colorado now have access to a stroke specialist at any time. They can start evaluation, diagnosis, they can show and transmit films, images, and all kinds of information directly to a specialist at the other end of the line within just a few minutes of dialing in. And that's really amazing. And it's going to give us the ability eventually, I think, to really get some diagnostic tools in the back of our ambulances and enable us to hook in directly to a physician while we have the patient in the field and make decisions about transport. This may be a solution that helps us solve some of the ER overcrowding problems, solve some of the transports that maybe didn't have to happen because patients are using us for primary care rather than having primary care for themselves. I think we're going to see a lot more of this as time advances. And it's something that's exciting. What do you think? You can comment on any of the things I'm talking about in this week's episode over at the forums or by email or directly at the podcast site. Leave comments and let me know what you think about the future of telemedicine with EMS. Since I'm talking a little bit about strokes, I think I'll touch on an item that I found in the news that has to do with patients who have higher risks for strokes and heart attacks if they've had a recent history of DVT, or venous thromboembolism. This is a study that comes out of Denmark, and a couple of professors there at the medical school looked at a 20-year population-based study from nationwide Danish medical databases. And they looked at patients who had a previous history of DVT and looked at the relationship of that DVT to other clot-related medical problems like strokes and heart attacks. And what they found was that a relative risk of heart attack was 60% higher for people in the first year after having a history of DVT, and that they had 119% higher chance of having a stroke than a control group following the first year of a DVT. Basically, what this is saying is people who are prevalent or have had their body form some kind of deep venous blood clot are more likely to form another blood clot. Now, this may seem like a no-brainer to some of you, but remember, we are really focusing now on science-based medicine. We're not going to just make assumptions that because it sounds like it should be a good idea, that it's the way we should be treating people. And so it's important for studies like these to really show where true correlations exist between medical conditions so that we can do a better job of treating these patients. What does this mean for us? Well, it means that we need to be good at taking our histories and talking to patients or family members and ask them, have you had a recent history of a DVT or a blood clot in your leg or somewhere else? If that's happened in the last year, then it is more likely this patient's having a heart attack, more likely that this patient's having a stroke or a TIA or some other kind of embolic event. And so we need to really keep an eye on this kind of thing. And it comes back to the things I always talk about. Take a good history. Make sure you cover that sample history and ask questions based upon the symptoms that you're seeing. Things like, this could be an MI. Well, have you had a blood clot in the past year? These are all things you can kind of keep in the back of your mind and throw it out there on the table when you get to the ER as some of the history that you find pertinent. This is the kind of thing that will show that you are a careful practitioner in your field, that you know what you're talking about, that you're educated, and that you're willing to get more education, find out how to be a better EMT or paramedic with your patients. Moving right along, I found a study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia, and the University of Liverpool in the UK that published recently about a leveling off of the decline in heart disease-related deaths. And this is particularly alarming because this decline is happening in the younger age ranges. This will be patients who are in the ages of 35 years of age or older. And while there had been some pretty steady declines in the number of heart disease-related deaths in recent years, that decline has started to level off. And in fact, in young women ages 35 and older, heart disease rates deaths are actually going up. And this is something that we, again, need to be aware of and keep in the back of our minds. The scientists in the study tie the relationship to the increased death rates to lifestyle problems, things that are easily corrected, things like obesity, diabetes, diet, smoking, other unhealthy habits and activities in our lives that are contributing to us having increased problems with heart disease at younger and younger ages. And I talked about this in a couple weeks ago in the podcast. So what we need to do is kind of be advocates for that in the field. We also need to be advocates for that in our own lives and understand that just because medical science can cure things or help alleviate symptoms, either through medications or through treatments, doesn't mean that it's carte blanche to eat whatever you want, to not exercise, to not watch your weight, and not take care of yourself. So I urge you to take a look at this study. There's a link to it in the show notes, as well as all the other news items, and take a look at what you can find out about alleviating risk factors in your life or the lives of those around you. And I'll wrap up with a story about some of those risk factors and alleviating them. We hear about smoking bans, and maybe your community or state or county or whatever has a ban on smoking in public places or in government buildings or maybe even in all business environments that are indoors. Is it worth it? Is it working? Are you a smoker and it drives you nuts? I don't know. But here's a study that looked at a countywide smoking ban in Indiana, and the smoking ban was for all public indoor environments. You had to smoke out of doors. You could not smoke indoors at all. Was it having an effect? So a researcher at the University of Indiana went ahead and looked at comparing this county to a similar county that had a demographic base that was the same. And what this study found was that for non-smokers admitted to hospitals with AMI-related symptoms, acute myocardial infarction, or other signs of heart disease or heart attack, that the numbers of these non-smokers who had heart attack symptoms went down in the county with a smoking ban when compared to the other county that did not have that smoking ban in place. This is definitely an indication that for the non-smokers out there, having smoking bans in place to protect you from secondhand smoke is having a positive effect. And ultimately, this helps us out as well because it means fewer heart attack victims, at least earlier in life, and we can save the back of our ambulance for those who are going to be in need of having heart attack assistance because they're smoking, whether there's a smoking ban or not. All right, enough of that soapbox. I did a lot of heart-related news stories this week, and sometimes it just kind of falls that way. But I think it's time for me to look at another installment of the ACLS refresher or review that I've been covering over the past couple of months. I did one about a month ago just talking about ACLS and cardiac care in general. And I think tonight I'll focus more on another aspect of ACLS and cardiac care. So for the tip and trick of the week this week, I'll be looking at tachycardias. Now, this may take me more than 1 week because I think tachycardias are one of the more difficult things for a lot of people to get under their belts. And I think this is based upon the different types of tachycardias there are. I mean, this is one of those things where is it a supraventricular? Is it a ventricular tachycardia? What's the basis of it? Is it wide? Is it narrow? Is it stable? Is it unstable? What do all these variables mean with tachycardias? Well, it comes back to really having a good handle on reading your strips. You really need to get a good 12 lead. You need to have a good 6 second strip of your primary lead. And you need to get a good handle on what you're looking at by reading your strip methodically. And if you check the Medicast site, do a search for EKGs, you'll see that I've covered reading rhythm strips in the past. And I may do a little bit more of that in the future as well. But the most important thing is to be methodical. First of all, get your rate. Second of all, is it regular or irregular? How fast is it? You know, really, really fast rate up, you know, over 200 is most often supraventricular. I don't want to say always, but most often. Just even if it's a wide complex, there may still be a P wave in there that you can't see because everything's too close together. So you need to kind of just be squared away on reading your strips. But if you can't, if you've got one that's just got you scratching your head, there's some very basic things you can do. First of all, is it narrow or wide? Okay. Is it, how fast is it? Is it regular? Okay. Regular, narrow, and very fast usually is an SVT or maybe even an A flutter, but it is not likely if it's regular to be atrial fibrillation. So you can rule that one out. Also, if it's irregular, is it irregular with a regular basis to it? Now, that sounds kind of funny if you don't know anything about reading rhythm strips, but we talk about irregularly irregular all the time around here, and it kind of gets funny. But the basis of it is that atrial fibrillation is one of those things that you're going to run into, and it is irregular all the way around. It's irregular, and it's not the same pattern of irregularity. That's as opposed to something like a heart block with a tachycardia going on, and you're going to see the same rhythm. You know, it's going to be irregular. Every three beats, you're going to miss a beat. Well, that's an irregular rhythm, but it's regular in the way that its rhythm progresses. So these are things you want to look for when you're identifying the rhythm. So this can still give you some clues, even if you can't spot whether there's P waves or not in the rhythm. If you've got a narrow, complex tachycardia, and it's regular, it's you're probably looking at an SVT or an A flutter. If it's irregular and it looks very irregular, you're looking at an AFib. So we've got a fast rhythm. It's narrow complex. That means we've got to get the pads on them and cardiovert them, right? Wrong. Treat the patient, not the monitor. We haven't asked one very important question yet. And that question is this patient stable or not stable? And by stable or not stable, whenever I'm talking about using electricity on another human being, I want to know if they're going to mind if I electrocute them. Now, that sounds kind of funny, but it is the way you need to think. If you think that someone's going to mind if you give them a paperclip and shove their hand into an electric socket, well, then they probably are going to mind if you put two pads on their chest and jolt them that way as much. So we need to keep this in the back of our mind. It doesn't mean we don't want to treat the underlying problem if it's necessary, but we need to look at the patient. If this guy's running at 220 and he's smiling at you and says, well, you know, I feel a little weird, but other than that, you know, I just feel like my heart's fluttering. Okay, this guy needs to be treated, but you don't need to shock him. You need to be prepared to shock him, but that is not the case at this instant. So treat the patient, not the monitor. I would say, and this is just, you know, again, for general information, you need to check your own protocols, you need to check your own medical director, your own preceptors and training. But I would be more inclined to treat these narrow complex, very fast rhythms with adenosine. I'm going to have a line in place. I'm going to have my pads out and ready to go if I need them. So I can go ahead and shock this patient or pace this patient if I need to. But we're going to try other things first. We're going to try vagal maneuvers. We're going to try to get this patient to bear down, and maybe we can stop that rhythm through that method. But if they start to become symptomatic, they start to experience chest pain or some shortness of breath, I'm going to go ahead and have my line in place and give them adenosine. And I'll save cardioversion for later on in the treatment plan if they become severely symptomatic. And by severely symptomatic, I mean unconscious, severely altered in mental status, severely hypotensive, or experiencing severe pulmonary edema. All of these things would be signs of a patient who is not stable and in need of immediate cardioversion. Otherwise, I'm going to just monitor these patients. If they're asymptomatic, I'm not going to do anything. O2, IV, monitor, transport them to the hospital. If they are experiencing symptoms, we'll start with vagal maneuvers. We'll upgrade that if needed to something like adenosine. Or if we have a suspected atrial fibrillation, maybe go ahead and consult and find out if it's okay to administer diltiazem, or possibly if your protocol allows or has provisions for it, something like amiodarone. And this is where you need to check your own protocols and know what's going on in your own area. Otherwise, you're just going to go ahead and transport these patients to the hospital. And so you just need to have a good understanding of why we treat the certain arrhythmias we run into the way we do. And remember to not over-treat any patient. We don't need to just use our skills because we happen to know how to do it, okay? And this is why tachyarrhythmias tend to freak people out, because, hey, do I shock them or not? Shocking's kind of severe. What do I do? Well, again, follow the steps I've outlined here. Follow your own protocols. Try to use all this and get a handle on what you do ahead of time. And this can give you a good basis to start from where you're looking at treating these type of upper heart arrhythmias, these narrow complex atrial-based arrhythmias that you run into. With the tip and trick of the week out of the way, and since I'm covering tachyarrhythmias, I thought I would go ahead and talk a little bit about adenosine. I've covered the other medication I mentioned, Cardizem, or diltiazem in the generic name, And I've done that in the past in other episodes of the Medicast. So go ahead and search over at the Medicast site for those episodes. But I will talk about adenosine here. Adenosine is a naturally occurring nucleoside. If you've done anything with cellular biology, maybe you remember adenosine triphosphate or adenosine diphosphate or even adenosine monophosphate. These are those energy-containing molecules that help the cells produce energy and use energy and all the things that go on there. It's the way the body stores energy in the bonds of adenosine triphosphate. But what about adenosine when we give it? Atrial fibrillation is one of those scary medications, and it's scary because it can cause a systole, it can cause ventricular fibrillation, it can cause a complete heart block, because atrial fibrillation is used to cause a complete but transient heart block in the heart at the AV node. This basically stops transmission of signals from the atrium through the AV node to the ventricles and will successfully block temporarily, hopefully, the transmission of a tachycardia signal from the atria to the ventricles and allow the system to reset. Of course, if this doesn't work or if the patient has transient pathways, other ways for the electricity to get from the atria to the ventricles, then you could precipitate a ventricular fibrillation. You could precipitate a series of a systole in the patient. So we need to be really prepared for the worst when giving this medication. And that goes back to what I talked about earlier when I was talking about tachycardias, that we need to treat the patient, not the monitor. We don't need to jump to giving medications or shocking the patient because there can be severe side effects. Couple of things you need to be keeping track of before giving adenosine. You want to have an IV line as close to the heart as possible. So this means you want to get an IV in the AC. You don't want to be getting one all the way down in the back of the hand. You want to have a nice big line. You want to have a flush of saline or lactated ringers, whatever your IV solution of choice in your jurisdiction is. 10 to 20 cc's. I know that they say 5 cc's, but adenosine has a very short half-life. The body uses it up very quickly in the system. So you need to push the adenosine in. You need to follow it up very rapidly with a flush. You need to open your fluid up and let it flow behind it for 30 seconds or so. After the flush, you want to make sure that adenosine gets into the vein and gets pushed close to the heart as quickly as possible so that it can have the desired effect rather than get used up on the way. And this is why we give doses the way we do. We give a dose first of 6 milligrams, and then if that doesn't work in the first 3 to 5 minutes, we'll go ahead and administer a dose of 12, and then 3 to 5 minutes after that, another dose of 12 milligrams. And this is to see if 6 is enough, then we don't want to give more than we need to give, but 12 or another 12 may be needed to reset things. Again, we need to be prepared for the worst, which is why we're going to have everything together to resuscitate this patient if we need to. Also, when you give this medication, I urge you to hit print before you push it so we can see the conversion on the strip and we can see what the rhythm converts back to after the adenosine has its effect. And this will happen over about 5 to 10 seconds, where you'll have maybe an asystole showing up on the strip, and then the patient will reconvert back into either the tachycardic rhythm you were trying to convert or into a sinus rhythm, hopefully. Contraindications for administering adenosine include AFib or A-flutter, second or third degree heart blocks, of course, ventricular tachycardia, and also signs of sick sinus syndrome, Stokes-Adams attack, Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. All of these are other forms of atrial tachycardias, or in the case of ventricular tachycardia, where you're not going to have any effect. second and third degree heart blocks. Also, you're not going to have any effect because if you block the AV node and it's a ventricular tachycardia, you're not going to have any effect on the tachycardia at all. And you may actually remove the ability of the atria to have any effect on the ventricles. Side effects of adenosine are facial flushing, lightheadedness, maybe a transient shortness of breath, nausea, all related to the fact that you are intentionally stopping a patient's heart. So they're going to have short-term effects based upon a cessation of their heart's pumping. They may have a brief nausea related to a shock response, lightheadedness, dizziness, or flushing, shortness of breath related to the fact that their heart stopped beating and they can't catch their breath. All of these things should last less than a minute or so, and the patient should begin to have either back to their symptoms they had before you administered the adenosine, or hopefully transfer into a stable rhythm where they're back into a normal sinus rhythm that's not tachycardic. In any case, this is adenosine, and it's one of those meds that we administer and something that you need to kind of be prepared for and be ready to administer if the patient's condition warrants it. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is going to wrap up another episode of the MedicCast. Remember, you can find links to everything I've talked about in the news items and both the tip and trick of the week and the med of the week, all in the show notes for this episode over at MedicCast.com. And you can also get a copy of those show notes with those links in it directly emailed to you. Go ahead and sign up for the MedicCast newsletter, and you'll get a copy of each week's show notes sent directly to your email box. So when you're listening to the show and you say, hey, I want to find out more about that, you can go back to your email and click those links directly to get that information. As always, remember to check your own protocols, your own medical direction for any of the things I've talked about today. I talk about this stuff for general information purposes. It's up to you to be knowledgeable about how to handle treatment for your own patients. In any case, you can catch up with me here by reaching me at podmedic@mac.com or calling into the voicemail line 941-30-MEDIC, 941-306-3342. Remember, in about a week, on the 11th of December, I will be hosting the next episode of the MedicCast Live, the live episode where we discuss a single topic, and you get a chance to participate either in the chat room or by calling in live to the show, and that'll be Tuesday, December 11th at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and I will be giving away t-shirts to a lucky winner who checks in at the show that night. So if you're going to be dialed in to TalkShoe.com and the MedicCast Live or calling in live to the show, you can get information on sending me a key phrase over at the MedicCast by email, and I will put you in the drawing for one of the listeners who was tuned into the show live that night to get a free t-shirt. And I'll tell you more about that at the MedicCast Live on the 11th. So check in with me then, and you can get a chance to win a t-shirt. There are only about maybe 15 to 20 people checking in on the show, so your chances are very good for winning a t-shirt over there at the MedicCast Live in about a week. And also, make sure you stay safe this week. This is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.
Red eye flight, come down to me. I got somewhere else to be. I'll be leaving here at 6 a.m. to see my family. All my sweaters, they've been packed. Bitter cold won't make me crack. Once I get there, I don't know. I don't care how I'm coming back. 'Cause I would walk 1,000 miles. I would walk 1,000 miles through the snow, rain, or bitter cold to be back home for Christmas. I've been gone too long to say, but I'm coming anyway. Any way I can to leave this town and get back home today. Let the snow fall through the air. I got 8 long hours to spare. I'll be waiting at the airport bar for 3, but I don't care. 'Cause I would walk 1,000 miles. I would walk 1,000 miles through the snow, rain, or bitter cold to be back home for Christmas. But this long flight don't bother me. 3 shepherds came to see a baby born this morning miles away from their locality. An angel singing clear hallelujah, Christ is coming here with no plane, with no train, just a will that's still determined to find me. You know he found me. So I would walk 1,000 miles, I would walk 1,000 miles through the snow or rain, or check out lines of traffic jams. And I would walk 1,000 miles, I would walk 1,000 miles through the snow or rain or winter storms to be back home for Christmas. I would walk 1,000 miles through the snow and the rain or bitter cold to be back home for Christmas.